Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan, and thank you for joining me for the 167th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. And during the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is Jimmy Manyuru. He was originally from Kenya and came to the United States to attend Middlebury College in 2003. He moved to Maine in 2016 with his wife and is presently the Associate Director of Student Life at Wayne Fleet in Portland, Maine, and the father of a nine-month-old daughter. Jimmy, thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you, Kate, for having me.
It's a pleasure. Most fun thing I could think of to do this Sunday. You are the eldest of eight children in your family, born in the bustling city of Mombasa, and then raised in your heart's true home, Magadi, 2 hours to the south near the Tanzanian border. When I looked up Magadi, I saw scenes from the movie Out of Africa, things like flamingos lifting to flight over wide, flat waters with a mountainous backdrop, and it's really, really gorgeous. Tell us about what life was like in Magadi for kids. What did you do for fun as a boy there?
Yeah, so Magadi is a mining town, and, you know, my dad's an engineer. So growing up there, one of the things that I loved about it is that it's a desert of a place, and you could just go out at the end of every day, actually, after school, after my dad would come back from work, would always take a walk. So we'd go take a walk, and we call it going down the valley, because a lot of the houses were built on top of the hill. On one side of the, up below the hill was the lake where they would mine soda ash and salt. And on the other side was a dried, I assume a dried, dried up lake. And there was sand there. And, you know, with my many siblings would go down there and just go out on hikes. I mean, we could do this after school. We could do this any other time during the weekends. And I think the other part about Magadi is also, it was a bit of a sheltered place. So to give you some context, you know, this is before pre-internet, and this is when the TV stations would basically start at 4 p.m. and shut down at 11. And the newspaper would actually arrive in the afternoon. The bus from Nairobi would bring the newspaper at 3 p.m. So you'd sort of not really know what was going on unless someone called you before that. And there was also, while it was also sheltered, there was also an interesting dynamic where, you know, this was a successful, fairly successful mining company at the time, but it was also built in a place where there was a marginalized group, the Maasai, that is the original land, and you could sort of see that dynamic play out where you've got this group that's sort of struggling to make ends meet, they're the nomadic group, and then you've got this company there. And so seeing that was also something that struck me.
Did the Maasai people benefit at all from the minerals that were removed from their land?
So that's one of those, you know, it's a complex question. And in one sense, the company did provide health services and, you know, water, which is a hard thing to come across there for them. But there's no direct, you know, so some of them would get employment from the company. But in terms of like a direct benefit, there's no sort of money being given to them. That's a question.
Yes. Well, yeah. It sounds like some reciprocity.
Yeah.
Some recognition.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds like a wonderful place to get to be a kid. I saw flamingos. Is there more natural wildlife that you enjoyed there?
There is plenty of flamingos, plenty of wildebeest, plenty of baboons. So it's all the, you know, some of the things that you not necessarily see in the city like Nairobi. So that was, there's a lot of that type of animal wildlife.
Do people eat the wild boar?
No, not really. People actually, I think, are not as adventurous in terms of what they'll feast on.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
we do have a restaurant that does, you know, put all out the meats from different animals, but it's really meant more for tourists who are being more adventurous, but most people tend to be clear with what they want to eat.
So, yeah, chickens? Yeah.
Chicken, goats, cow, that type of thing.
Yeah, those are pretty popular worldwide.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that your family valued that you bring with you through life?
I think the sense of family being first. So that's very explicitly said, you know, that family comes first. You know, if you're having meals, you're going to have the meals together and you'll, you know, just catch up on your day. So that's been something that definitely sticks out for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how does that play out for you here now that your family is in Portland, Maine?
Well, with my wife, Megan, and my daughter, Bailey, we try to do that as well. I mean, we're still learning the ropes with our 9-month-old. And every day is a new day, figuring out new things. But, you know, coming up with some routines and things that we do together, just sort of having that type of thing, like whether it's taking a walk together and just having those things that we do that we know this is our time.
Yeah. So do you get home from work and go on a walk?
Not so much now with the weather as it is. But
glazed sidewalks.
But when the weather is nicer, we'll do that. But we definitely, what we'll do is that we'll spend time, you know, when you get back, just time to play with Bailey. And so just, it's our half an hour, just the three of us.
Do you imagine that she'll grow up and play rugby like you did?
That's a good question. I think everyone's been putting in for her to play different sports. So Megan was a dancer, so she wants her to do some dancing. But I wouldn't mind her trying out some rugby or at least having some good knowledge of it.
We need to get a youth rugby league going around here.
Yeah.
Get those girls involved early.
Yeah, we'll get her in there. We should probably lead the team there.
How would you describe life in Nairobi around 2000? You left the very rural Magadi and went back to Nairobi for your education. Did you imagine that you would one day leave your life in Kenya and be here?
So, yes and no. On one part, there was, you know, Nairobi is a bustling city. You have to have your wits around you. I love it. It's a place that, you know, there's always just things going on. It's a place that I definitely recommend for people to have. If you have a chance, you should definitely visit Nairobi. I think for me, being in high school at the time, I was getting the point of thinking about what do I want to do post high school, and Kenya, being a British colony, has followed that. A former British colony has followed that British education style, where basically, you know, you finish your 8th grade and you do national exams, you determine where you go to high school, you finish your high school, and your national exams results determine what you're going to do in college. And I don't think I was really ready to figure out what I wanted to do. I knew what I was interested in doing, but I don't think I was ready to commit to something specific. And I had friends who had gone to college in the US, and every time they would come back, they would talk about the liberal arts education and their experiences with that. And it sounded like something I would definitely want to try out. So on that part, I knew I would be willing to try that. But the other part was sort of, how do you get to that place? How do you get to applying to the colleges? How do you get to convince your parents to let you, you know, go outside of the country for that type of education? It was percolating in my mind, but I was not quite sure yet if that was the direction I was going to go.
And how did your family feel about you leaving and going so far away to school when you were just 17 or 18?
So my parents were, I know there's the usual, I'll call it misconception of what happens when people leave to go to the US. You know, people get worried that is your child going to get lost? That's sort of the big thing. And also it's just the cost of it. It's definitely the exorbitant cost of college here. So two things did help. One is that, you know, I did get a good financial aid package from the college. And the other was my mom sort of, you know, had some sway in sort of telling my dad basically that, you know, if he's old enough at this point. If he was going to get lost, he'll get lost here, he'll get lost there. But you've got to have faith that you've done the right thing and he'll know what's best.
Yeah. So thanks, Mom.
Yes.
For sharing Jimmy with us here. Nairobi itself, can you give us a little picture, a snapshot? I understand it's very busy, traffic's crazy busy and going all directions. What does it feel like to be in Nairobi?
Nairobi is, it's like you mentioned, it's definitely a busy place. There's a good mix of different cultures in Nairobi. And I mean, by that I mean, you'll go there and you'll find, you know, you've got Kenyans of different ethnic groups. You've got all these different nationalities there because a lot of companies tend to base their operations from Nairobi, even though they may be working in the greater East Africa region. So you have the different, you know, and even socioeconomic background, like you have the people who live in the huge mansions. You've got the slums that also exist there. So there's just definitely a vibrant place, and there's, I feel like there's always something for everyone. If you just have to find where your niche is, but there's always something to do there.
Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of fresh food there? Is it grown out in the farms and brought into the city?
There are. So when you talk about the marketplaces, there's definitely, you know, you can go and get things, right? Sort of like the food markets that you have, the farmers market that you have here, but on a bigger scale with more negotiations that you could do for the things that you're getting there.
Are you a barterer?
I am. I would say I can hold my own. I don't think I'm as good as my sister. So she's definitely, she's the one who knows how to do.
What does she do? How do you make a good bartering system?
I think it's, well, not so much of the barter, but the negotiation piece. So yes, she definitely knows how to sell her point across, get the message across, and, you know, convince the other person that I'm actually doing you a favor by, you know, giving this lower price. Yeah, this is really what you want.
Oh, that's good. A little marketing, probably a little acting. I'd walk away if this isn't going to work. Right?
Yeah.
So you can hold your own, though.
I think I can hold my own. I think one of my favorite, one of the last things I did before I left for my first time around coming to college is I'd gone shopping with my mom, and we bought this painting that we now have hanging in our living room. And it was, I think that was one of the best moments of negotiations that I've had to do then. And it's also like, that was really the only money I had. So there was really nothing else to do.
That's right. You weren't faking. You really weren't going to go any higher. That's funny. And how about food in Kenya? What kinds of favorite dishes do you miss when you think back to your life, maybe in Nairobi?
Definitely chapatis and samosas. That stands up. We'd have chapatis every Friday, so I do miss that.
Say what a chapati is. Yeah.
So chapati is actually, this is one of the influences from India that's now found its way to Kenya, and it's a bread that you roll out the dough and lightly put it on a pan and on a hot pan, and then feast on it.
Like a naan?
It's like a naan type of bread. Mm-hmm. It is very labor intensive, so it's not something that's very easy to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're grateful to the cooks.
Yes.
Right. So you can't get that here, or you can?
You can get some, but not the same way. So I think it's sometimes that it might be the way they make it or the flour that is used, but it's not. I always enjoy it when I go back. And the similar thing with samosa. It's not as easy because every place you go to has a slightly different twist that they make to it. And so finding the one that, you know, that you've grown up with is not as easy.
And what's your favorite filling for a samosa?
Beef mm-hmm. samosas. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think they're really such a brilliant package that everybody thought it was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really are widely used throughout the world.
Yes.
A little fried dough package with meat and vegetables inside.
Yeah, and I think you find different names, different variations to it. That so you'll definitely
sambusa,
something to see it. Yes.
Yeah, samosa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're delicious no matter how you slice them, whatever you call them. I love them too. So you left Kenya when you were 17 to go to Middlebury College. You already spoke English, of course, but surely the culture was somewhat foreign. I wonder what that transition was like for you as a young man going to Vermont from Kenya.
Yeah, you know, you think you know a lot about a place because for the most part, the U.S. tends to be well known outside of the U.S. by other people. So because through whether it's media or Hollywood, but it's
different. We blow up cars all the time here.
You know, so I think some of the things that were definitely different was, like, I remember when I first arrived, I arrived in Boston and I was somewhere in Somerville and I thought, okay, you know, I'll try and walk. If I'm here, I might as well go to Harvard and see where the famous Harvard University is. So I asked people, where is Harvard? And everyone would tell me, just a few blocks down that way. And after walking for what seemed like eternity, people kept on telling me that. And I realized, you know, it's just some of this cultural context. You know, people mostly drive, so they assumed I was driving and they were telling me it was just down the street, but it was actually more than a couple of hours walk there. And then, you know, you get to college and I had a suite with six other people, so there's two in a room, and in my suite was actually half of us were international students. So it's myself from Kenya, someone from Zimbabwe, and one other person from Mexico, and then the other three were all had grown up in the US. And I remember overhearing two of my suite mates who have grown up in the US making the comments, how do these guys come from the other part of the world with only two suitcases, and our parents dropped us off with a truck full of stuff. And I think it's also that was my mind where I realized, you know, there's a difference in how we see things and how we approach things. And then, you know, you also have some of the more small things, like not small, but I think about like the weather. You know, that was one of the things where the fall is now my favorite season. By the time not knowing about layering up and knowing that the temperature can drop as easily as it can in that time period, that was definitely a quick learning experience.
Yes, it's beautiful when you come, summer-like, but just weeks later, not so much.
Yep.
Yeah, was your first snow here, or had you seen that on Mount Kenya?
So I'd seen it from Mount Kenya from a distance, but I think one of my first experiences with this the snow was actually during a rugby game. And that was also another moment of literalizing perspectives, where basically at halftime during the game, it began snowing. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't need to be here. This is self-inflicted here. And my teammate who's from upstate New York looks up and says, this is so beautiful. So that was my first time with the snow.
Yes, seeing it through someone else's eyes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's something to adjust to for sure. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to New Mainers Speak. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Jimmy Manyuru. He was originally from Kenya, but has lived in the U.S. since 2003 and came to Maine in 2016 to be the Associate Director of Student Life at Waynefleet, where he also teaches a bit too. So tell us, Jimmy, why you wanted to work at Waynefleet. How does its mission specifically speak to you?
Yeah, so what I love about the mission is there's a phrase in the mission that talks about developing students who have a responsible and caring participation in the world. And that speaks to, you know, I think when you have missions that are articulated that way, it's easier for you to try to live up that mission. And to me, I believe in that. I also think this is something about how we talk about, you know, this tension between trying to have playful exploration and rigor of expectations, you know, having security, but also providing a place where we can challenge students. I think those types of things lead to conversations where I feel we can do better work because we're always trying to improve on this. And I think when I came to Waynefleet, I was looking basically for a few things. You know, one was I was looking to be able to grow professionally. I was looking to learn from the head of school, sort of see what his vision was and see if I could learn more from that. And I was looking for a school that had a more progressive pedagogy. And so I felt I could find those things at Waynefleet.
Yeah, and you've been here for long enough, well, a couple years. Yeah, and have you found it to be what you thought it would be? Does it have progressive, progressive pedagogy?
Yeah, I think we do have some, and I think there's always room for improvement. I think we're in a good place to take it the next level. So I think what I was hoping for is there, and I think there's always that next step.
Yeah, so what would that next step look like?
For me, it's the idea of how do we look at things in terms of educational learning and how do we include our students. So when you're talking about, you know, brain science, I think about how well are we looking at the research and how well are we doing that in our, you know, our teaching and in our assessments. When you talk about inclusion, how do we make sure our students are not just, we're not just talking about diversity, we're also talking about inclusivity. And how do we go about doing that?
Those are tough problems to solve.
Yeah.
Although we really do have a lot of information.
We do.
It surprises me sometimes. Like, for instance, we know that if you move around actively for 5-10 minutes, your learning goes up something like 50% or something like that. So why wouldn't we make 5 or 10 minute breaks between classes where we're really active?
Right. And I think it's sometimes we have to frame those things, because I think when we know these things, it's easy enough to speak at them from a distance. But one of the things I've learned is to try and frame the conversations in ways that, how does it impact a specific classroom? So talking about how do we have what are the experiences our students or even faculty sometimes are having in our schools. So I think when we frame it in a way that it can be articulated to a specific classroom or specific experience that someone's having, that's helpful.
Yeah, and yet inclusion issues can lead to really difficult conversations sometimes.
Yes.
How do you go about fostering and supporting difficult conversations that are raised around campus regarding diversity and belonging?
So I think that goes back to what I was talking about, the idea of how do we frame things. So how do we make sure that we're talking about issues in a way that, first of all, we meet people where they are, because I think you also want people to get on board with what you're talking about. And how do we basically set up those experiences so that we can have these conversations and have people have reflections or moments of learning from other people? Because I think when we do that, then we can be able to have an opportunity for people to then see, okay, I may have been... Because I think one of the things I think of when we talk about our society is that we tend to talk about valuing multiculturalism, but we also look at things from a monocultural perspective. And so how do we then move from that monoculture idea to basically saying, okay, well, let's actually embrace what we are trying to do.
I like that. It's kind of like moving from the idea of having African History Month,
right,
to just integrating all those things right in. Women's
right.
history, African history, LGBT history, shouldn't it all just be part of history?
It's all part of history, yeah.
Yeah. So bringing that in a more holistic way, it's a great idea. Last week when we were visiting, you were talking about code switching. And I wonder if you could explain exactly what that is to people, and then how talk about how unspoken cultural rules play out in your daily life as a Mainer.
Yeah, I think when people talk about code switching sometimes, they talk about the idea of, when it's very linguistically, it's the idea of if you speak two languages and you switch from speaking one language to the other, how do you switch that in a way you keep up with the rules of the languages? I tend to think of it more from the cultural side of things and the way that we might do something in one environment and it changes in another environment. I think about, for example, in the US, you know, one of the easy ways to start a conversation tends to be talking about the weather. When I'm in Kenya, though, that's not really something that's going to be talked about much, because the weather is not...
Same every day, yeah. Gorgeous again.
And so I think what will happen in Kenya, though, is that we'll talk more about politics. And I mean, by politics, I mean, you know, current events, like what's going on type of thing. Like, that's going to be the conversation starter. And so I think when I switch from one place to the other, I sometimes don't even realize I'm doing that, but I think that's kind of sticks out there. Like, and there's things like that could be more, that are more, you know, some are more serious and some are lighter. Like, you know, you think about the issue of traffic in Nairobi. If you grew up in Nairobi, traffic is going to be something you're going to talk about, because that's, if you think New York traffic is bad, then you haven't been to Nairobi yet.
Yes.
And so that's one of the ways. But on a more serious level, though, I think, like, it goes back to the idea of the monocultural way of looking at things. You know, the US has got many different cultures in it, but tends to adopt more of the white or Caucasian sort of way of looking at things. And so that tends to be the code switch about how do people try and, whether it's integrate or fit in, but there's that part of things that people try to do to get there. Yet when they're in their own, when I think about it, even here in the US again, when I go to the barber, for example, to get my haircut, that's a very different way of speaking, and what's going to be talked about is very different from when I'm elsewhere in the other parts of the country.
Yeah, I think that's really, it's a bit about being multicultural,
right,
within oneself, isn't it?
Yes, and I think the it's multicultural within oneself, and sometimes it tends to be the, if you're not in the dominant culture, then you have to do more of the code switching, because you sort of have to be in that, live in that space, but you also have your own cultural that you're more accustomed
sure.
to.
Sure, there's the jargon and the colloquial language we use with friends, and then there's our professional language. I think we all do that at some level anyway, but then, yeah, some people have a farther way to go for their switch.
Right.
Yeah, and just... There's a lot of picking up on cues, right, to know when to use which.
Right, and sometimes if you don't have that background, if someone has not really told you about it, then it might be harder for some people to be able to actually know what's going on.
Yeah, and you have kids from all over the world at Wayne Fleet. How many students do you have?
We have about 550 students. So this is above. We have kids from 3-year-old all the way to 12th grade.
And then... About how many, what percentage of that are foreign-born kids or first-generation kids?
That's a good question. I don't know if we have this, if I have access to that statistic itself. But I think in terms of just talking about our students of color, I would say we have about 17 to 20% there.
Mm-hmm. I think Wayne Fleet has done a remarkable job of making sure you have diversity. It would be easy as a private school to not have diversity. It's an expensive private school.
Right. And I think one of the things that we've realized is that that is actually a key part of having a good education experience, that we need to have that diversity, because it's not just that, well, we are sort of saying, okay, we're doing this good thing, but it's actually we need to have a diversity to be able to have a good educational program.
Yeah. Think of what rich conversations come.
Right.
When you are having all kinds of people with different viewpoints.
Yes.
Safe enough to put their views on the table.
Right. And then, and with that then goes to the idea of, so when we bring in the diversity, then figuring out, we don't just have bringing diversity, because I think about someone who's very thoughtful about these issues on inclusivity sort of says, you don't want to necessarily have a situation where basically the people, when you talk about diversity, it could just be that you're sort of saying, all right, you're welcome here. You're a guest in a sense, and you will make you feel welcome.
Right.
We want to move to inclusivity, where basically we're saying, all right, you actually belong here and you have the keys to the house, and so you can leave, come and go as you wish. And that's sort of what I think what we're trying to work towards.
I think that's a really important distinction. It's one thing to be a guest and a whole other thing to be another member of the family.
Right.
Yeah. I know you're really enjoying working in the field of education, and I wonder, what kinds of things do you hope will become normal practice by the time your baby daughter is a high school student?
Yeah, so this goes back to one of the things I said earlier on, and I think it's the idea of brain science, being more thoughtful about how we teach, you know, being able to look at the research and see what is the whole idea of learning about learning. How do we go about that? How do we go about doing our assessments? And then also thinking about the idea of how do we include people? How do we make our schools as, you know, welcoming to as a wide array of people as would like them to be? So looking at things like, you know, what do we do that we should keep doing? What do we do that we should stop doing? And what should we be improving upon?
I hope we have a fabulous school system all ready to go for your daughter when she reaches it. That sounds great. I'd like to send lots of kids through that system.
Yes.
Jimmy, you are really engaging and grounded and have your eye on ways to make the world an even better place for everyone. I'm sure your career will continue to unfold beautifully, and I wish you and your family the very best here in Maine.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you so much for being my guest today.
It was a pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. Please join us each week for similar interviews with diverse members of our community. If you would like to hear this complete interview or interviews from previous weeks, please visit newmainerspeak.com and check out more related information at facebook.com/newmainerspeak. New Mainers Speak is also rebroadcast on Mondays at 4:30 p.m. on WERU-FM in Blue Hill and Bangor area. I'm Kate Manahan, closing today's program with a song that Jimmy has selected for us. Jimmy, can you tell us why you chose this song to wrap things up?
I think this is actually the most difficult question you had for me, to figure out what song to play. Beres Hammond is one of my favorite artists, and so this is a song that I've played often, and actually this is one, when Bailey was born, would play this a lot when we're trying to put her to bed.
Great. This is called I Feel Good by Beres Hammond.
Oh, what a night. What a night, what a night. Oh, gosh, what a night. I feel good when you're wrapped up in my arms, dancing to a reggae song. Feel good, feel good. I feel good, 'cause your perfume isn't loud, and only I can talk about. Feel good, feel good. You feel like velvet rubbing over my skin, when your hair dances on the machine. Wish we were alone, baby, just the two of us. Yes, every move you make gives me a rush. Whoa, oh. Whine some more and show me that love unconditionally. Make believe we're alone, just you and me. Take the problems, leave them behind. Don't
when you're wrapped up in my arms, dancing to a reggae song. Feel good, feel good, I feel good, 'cause your perfume isn't loud, that only I can talk about. Feel good, feel good. Sweat off of your face, but it looks so good I might have to replace. This moment is magic, so I leave it alone until you say I need time to go home. Oh, oh, oh. Wine some more and show me that love unconditionally. Make believe we're here alone, just you and me. Take the problems, leave them behind, don't let it show. Go baby, go baby, go baby, go baby, go. I feel good when I'm wrapped up in your arms, dancing to a reggae song. Feel good, feel good, I feel good, 'cause your perfume isn't loud, that only I can talk about. Feel good, feel good, yes. Oh, what a night, what a night, yes. What a sweet, sweet night, full of vibes. Oh, what a night.